Hello, and thank you for joining this MedCast series titled Personalizing Dry Eye Disease Management. I'm Kelly Nichols, Dean of the University of Alabama at Birmingham School of Optometry.
Hi, I'm Laura Perryman, Seattle, Washington, founder and director of Dry Eye Services and Clinical Research at the Perryman Eye Institute.
Today, we're going to explore the management of dry eye using conventional and some new pharmacologic treatments, as well as some strategies for tailoring an approach to diagnosis and management based on individual patient characteristics. To discuss this more, we're joined today by Dr. Celia Ketting, member of the Intrepid Eye Society and faculty at the University of Colorado School of Medicine. Thank you so much for joining us today. Let's get started. We're talking about personalizing dry disease management. How do you do that in your clinic, and what kind of patient factors do you look at to kind of consider a unique approach?
So I know for me, every patient is an individual. You really have to make sure that you're looking at the patient as a whole, looking at what are their systemic diseases, what other things are going on, what's their socioeconomic status, how well can they really obtain some of these treatments that I need them to get. And I use that along with the clinical signs and findings to kind of really tailor it to my patients individually.
So how does that start? Like, does it start when a patient is with your staff at first, or do you really start tailoring it once they get to you?
I think probably a little bit of both. Obviously, when they're with my staff, they're getting testing done. We're doing our TR osmolarity. We're looking at our we're doing lipid scan, so we're looking at our mammography, as well as they're doing a entrance speed questionnaire. But they're also asking them questions. My staff is really good about asking questions about what else is going on health-wise, especially if they're new to the UC system. There is a little bit of benefit if they're within the UC system. I actually have access to all of their other records, so I know and I can get a better full history. But if we don't have that, we really want to be pulling what medications are they on, being really aware that not only just medications that they're prescribed, but over-the-counter medications that they might be taking, any supplements that they might be taking, and really getting a good complete history on these patients.
That history, is it taken on paper or electronically when they first come in by your staff?
So both, when somebody's new to the UC system, they will actually get they'll get pinged online through their email to do an entrance, paperwork of what medication are you on, what other diagnoses do you have, doctors that you've seen. A lot of times that doesn't get filled out, or my patients may be a little bit less tech savvy, and it may not be something that they can do. And so then we go through that with them in paper. When they check in, they'll get paperwork to fill out if they haven't filled it out online. And then the staff will go through it, especially like looking for any areas where it's not been filled in to really make sure that we're getting a full, complete picture of the patient.
Good. Laura, what about you? How's your staff manage patients as they come in?
Well, it's interesting because I totally agree with Dr. Ketting. The bulk of this is taking a thorough history. That past medical, those current meds, even lifestyle, like smoking and vaping, those things factor very much into identifying contributing factors to ocular surface disease. And that takes a lot of man hours. So what we've done is we've employed a HIPAA compliant platform called Jot Forms. And all those intake forms are now link shareable by text and QR codable on site. So all of our consent forms and intake forms, everything is on that system, which eases and streamlines. Even grandma knows how to use a QR code, right? These days, thank goodness. So it's a way to help streamline some of that processes. And then we export it to PDF and load it into the chart.
So how do you see it? Like, are you looking at it as a PDF in the chart?
Yes, so ours is a PDF in the chart, and it's very helpful to the patient to go through that exercise. We do a very exhaustive intake form because it helps them organize and see connections on their own before they even talk to us. And so when we ask them to share their dry eye story, it's more organized and they're able to like really explain what they've experienced and what they've gone through. And I'm listening carefully for subtle little things during their expression verbally of their history, not just what I'm seeing on the paperwork.
Cecilia, you mentioned the speed survey. Is that your preferred dry eye diagnostic survey to give to your patients?
It is. I've gone through a couple iterations of other surveys and combined surveys, and I've really kind of come back to using the speed questionnaire. And it really just is because I'm just at the base of it, trying to get them to start thinking about things. If I really could do what Laura's doing and have this really full survey looking at sleep patterns, looking at nutritional health, looking at all of these things, I want all of that information. It'd be lovely to get it before. Just unfortunately, at the university, we're not at that spot. And all of us in different practices, we can do it differently. So I've really kind of just stuck back to the speed because I think it gets, again, just that base information that I really need and getting my patient's brain geared to the conversation that we're going to have.
Is that done by your staff too, or do you hand it to them if you suspect something?
Yeah, so I'm in ocular surface disease clinic. So every patient I'm seeing is for
Is going
ocular
to do it.
surface disease or an emergency, right? So they do all get the speed questionnaire. So they're left in the room with it while they're waiting for me so that they can fill it out while they're waiting and have it done. And if I see that there's some questions missing, they're things I'm going to chat with the patient about anyway. So I can just touch base that direction.
So we're kind of heading a little bit now into sort of dry eye diagnosis, and I'm imagining this wonderful case history and then a survey or not or whatnot is really an important part. Probably, I would argue, almost the most important part. Some people say that, well, my patients aren't having any symptoms, and I kind of think it's that they aren't being asked the right
I
questions
ask the
sometimes.
question.
That's
Exactly.
exactly. Yeah, so after you've done this, I mean, you also probably have a good history of what they've tried and failed in the past, especially if you're all dry eye clinics primarily. And so, your groups or your patients might be a little bit different than just a regular clinical practice where they're seeing a variety of different things. So you probably have a really unique perspective and a very streamlined diagnostic pattern, which I know I'd like to hear both of yours, like how you do that and what your what are the tests that are the most critical for you?
Yep. And so to that, I've only been here for about 8 months. Prior to that, I was doing ocular surface disease like most of us do, on top of everything else that we're looking at with their glaucoma and things like that. So it really has been nice to have and develop this much more streamlined ability to just, yep, this is what's going on, and these are all the tests that they're going to get. So where patients start as they come in. If they're coming in for a new dry eye evaluation, they're going to get a tear osmolarity. They're going to get a mibography. They're going to have their speed questionnaire. There's a few more things that bells and whistles that we will be adding in the next coming months. But for right now, that's really where we're at. Past that, we're getting into the slit lamp. We're doing vital dyes, and I'm pushing on the glands. We're looking at the evaluation there, along with being able to talk about the mibography with the patients. But where do I really hang my hat? I really hang my hat on three things: that discussion with the patient, the patient history, their life, what's going on, talking about other inflammatory factors within their body. I hang my hat on my slit lamp exam with a vital dye and pushing on those glands. And those, everybody has that, right? We can say we don't have an ocular surface disease clinic, but you do because you have a slit lamp. So that, as well as my bibliography, those are my three things that I really want. The speed questionnaire, it's great, but I'm going to get it from a conversation with the patient anyway.
Do you use the mibography as a teaching tool?
Yes. Yep. I actually had a patient this morning who came in and she's like, "Are we going to look at those white picket fences again?" I'm like,
I
"Oh,
love
that's how
it.
I describe it." Yes. So, yes, I
It's good that
absolutely.
she has white picket fences, right?
No, she actually didn't. She was missing them. But so I use it as a teaching tool to say, "Hey, look, do you feel how I'm pushing on your glands as I'm going through at the slit lamp? This oil should come out when you blink. Do you feel how hard I'm pushing? You don't blink that hard, and it's not coming out. So that's not good. Then we're going to look at the structure." And so then we look at the picture and I say, "Okay, so this tells me how worried and how long has this been going on and how aggressive do we need to be as far as treatment?" And it really gives them a visual so that they can start to understand what the problem is, why those are important, and have something that they can come back. Same, similar with tear osmolarity of what are my numbers, doc? Where am I? Am I better? Are we going to take a picture again today? So that it just, I think it helps in compliance because they want to know that they're doing better and they want to do things to get better.
Mm-hmm. Do either of you use Inflamadry?
I do.
I have in the past.
Yeah, I do use it.
Do not have the ability right now.
Yeah. How does Hopefully, it fit in with I think you? It's a very powerful tool for getting an idea of just how much inflammation is running amok, that you can't hang your hat on the redness of the eye for the amount of inflammatory mediators in the tear film. And so I find that Inflamadry test to be easy to do. And it tells me a lot. It also helps direct me on how aggressive I need to be. And it's another visual teaching point between doc and patients. Like, gosh, there's a lot of inflammation here. We need to get this down as quickly and comprehensively as possible. It creates engagement for the patient. They understand why you're asking them to do more than, say, their neighbor that came in and recommended you.
Right. I think that we do finally have some tools to help us differentiate the amount of inflammation that you can see on the ocular surface. I think that's great. Not all places incorporate it, just because certain clinical settings, it's challenging to bring it in. Mm-hmm. But I think we're still seeing, like, in some certain clinics, especially in dry eyes, mostly clinics, that more that people are adopting it or using it pretty frequently.
I've had it before, and I agree exactly with Dr. Perriman, that it's really nice to have and just understand where we are with the levels of inflammation. The other one that I am excited that we will be bringing in that's pretty new is the TPOC, which looks at lactoferrin and IgE. Mm-hmm. Just for that is another thing to start to look at and really get a better understanding of what does that play? What role does that play in my dry eye patients, and what is that going to do to change who I'm treating and how I'm treating in my decision making?
Right. What about contact lenses? I know you have probably more severe dry eye practices than most. So maybe the contact lenses aren't as common, but comment on that for me.
So I'm not fitting contact lenses, unless it's a bandage contact lens. However, doesn't mean I don't see patients who wear contact lenses. And I also refer out heavily for scleral lenses, especially in my Sjogren's patients and or patients that have, I've got a fair amount of graft versus host and pemphigoid. And I find that it's really, really helpful for those patients. And even a bandage contact lens, I have a patient who was having a lot of light sensitivity and wind sensitivity as we were finally getting his corneal nerves to start to function again. They were essentially over-functioning and very sensitive. And so by putting him in a bandage lens or in a contact lens daily, not sleeping in them, but wearing them every day, that actually helped with him an ability to function while everything else was still kind of getting back in gear and functioning properly.
I see a lot of those contact lens intolerance dry patients. And, if you're high myope, you're highly motivated to get back into your contact lenses. And I love rolling up my sleeves and shouldering in to get things under control so that they can wear them, because visual performance wise, there's no contest if you're a high myope or a high hyperope for that matter. And then I loved what Dr. Ketting said about the sclerals. They definitely have a role. They can help to protect those corneal nerves, recreate that moist environment for the corneal epithelium, relieve symptoms, relieve friction. So I find them to be a really helpful adjunct from the, early stage contact lens intolerant patient all the way to the later stage disease and need for scleral lens referral. And then I view my job as keeping them in those lenses, whatever they may be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think it's a real good point. Not everybody likes to fit scleral lenses or feels comfortable doing it. It does take, some practice. I'd say, now in optometry school, students are learning it more than they did like when I was in school. Excellent. But still, even after graduation, unless you do maybe a contact lens residency, you may not get as much or as comfortable. So I love it that you both are finding people in your areas to refer to. That's fantastic.
And it's a great partnership. Like, there's things that they don't want to do that my scleral lens colleagues, we have two fabulous sources in the greater Seattle area, Dr. Noah Saif and Dr. Anita Lamb, that it becomes this really nice collaborative team care for the patient. And the patients really appreciate that and respect that. And it's a great system.
As opposed to saying, hey, go find someone. And you're able to say, I know this person and I know they do it well. And I want you to see them.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's like, oh, I loved her. It's like great. So it's nice.
Well, before we move into sort of treatments, is there anything else either of you would like to ask or say, you know, offer about diagnosis?
I really loved what Dr. Ketting said about, you know, that bar to entry. It's like, oh gosh, I don't have all the equipment to have a dry eye clinic. You do. You've got your eyes, your ears, your heart, and your dyes and your slit lamp. That's all you really need. Yeah. So I think some of our colleagues can feel a little intimidated about being more aggressive with dry disease management, but you already have everything you need.
Yeah, I think Dr. Ketting's approach too is really great. Like, start with some things, build onto that, and then build onto that more as new technology comes out, because we're seeing some pretty, you know, new technology that I think is going to be interesting to see in clinics. And even some combined technology that for somebody who doesn't have anything extra right now would be really interesting going forward. So I think we'll see some good stuff in the next year or so.
I agree. Think one thing I would tag on to what I didn't say is, if it doesn't make sense, check your corneal sensitivity.
Ooh, good girl. Yes,
got to do it.
Loving that one. Yes. Yeah,
that's so true. I know. I look at that, and actually we're going to talk about Demodex in a minute, but how many misdiagnoses did we make in our earlier years?
When oh my goodness. Yes. At the right between things? Between not looking down and then not checking corneal sensitivity, so many that I can sit there and go, oh, can they come back now? I think I can fix that.
I can fix them now. Yeah, I know.
I can fix that better than I did.
But I, you know, it's nice. Our younger colleagues aren't going to have this perspective of like, oh gosh, there was all these things that I missed. And, you know, but maybe as we get these other technologies on board and see these incredible progresses, we'll be able to tease apart other things that we missed before. Yeah. We'll just keep growing the knowledge and our capacity to help these patients. It's so exciting.
Yeah, no, I really agree with that. I mean, and it's not necessarily like we did a misdiagnosis. It was that we didn't have all the tools available to make the diagnosis. So
that's right.
Yeah, now we are much better equipped to help some of these really severe patients. Those are the ones I feel the most for, that I wish I could have done more. But we didn't even have the ability to really look at the meibomian glands either. I mean, you kind of could, but we weren't. And so I think that's actually been a game changer as well.
I agree.
Well, let's talk a little bit about using anti-inflammatory treatments and like what types of patients you might use those for, as we're trying to think about patient factors and specific kinds of patients. Dr. Ketting, how do you approach using, it can be anti-inflammatory like steroid, or it can be some of the others as well.
So, I mean, with a steroid, anytime we've got somebody who's got a flare up or somebody who's coming in really hot, they've got an eye, they've got a lot of active inflammation. I'm seeing any kind of sign of limbal stem cell deficiency, or that they're not functioning properly, I'm putting them on a steroid to start to calm that down and get some of the stress off. And you know, I'm very quick to jump on using a steroid as long as they're overall very safe, right? We know that we've got different ones that work well. I also don't hesitate to compound preservative-free dexamethasone. That is one thing that I have used for years. Learned that one from Liz Yu to use that in our patients, and called it liquid gold, because it really just calms down that front surface without adding extra things that are going to cause more irritation. And dexamethasone, we think of as being kind of a harsh topical drop, but when it's preservative-free, it actually, in its compound, it's phenomenal. So I tend to gravitate that way. But when we're talking more long-term anti-inflammatory, we're looking at our cyclosporins or our lofitegrast. And I think we got to remember, we can't lump all the cyclosporins together in the different percentages. They function and work very differently, and their onset to improvement in symptoms and signs is very different between our 0.09% and our 0.05%. And then also now we've got a new drop that has 0.1% coupled with perfluoropentahexane. I said that correct.
Pentobutane, yeah.
Pentobutane, there we go. Butane. Thank you.
The cousin.
And who am I picking those for, right? Obviously, we think about the patients who are more of an aqueous deficient and working to help produce more tears, better quality tears, but don't forget that they're an anti-inflammatory. So anybody who has something where it's an autoimmune issue, getting them on something that's one of these is really important for a long-term maintenance, not necessarily even to improve. And I talk about that heavily with my Sjogren's patients. I'm not necessarily going to get you feeling any better than you are today. I want to, and I will try my best to, but I want to make sure that you don't feel worse tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And that is a big key to what I do, is making sure that we're doing anything I can to decrease the inflammation.
Yes. That was an amazing comprehensive approach to inflammation control of the ocular surface. You know, I think in the practical wild, one of my frustrations is prescribing a specific steroid because of its safety, low BAK efficacy, and it getting swapped out for some generic that's yes. not equivalent or not even on the same diagnosis code that I entered in. So that's one of my frustrations as a clinician, that the health insurance companies, mm-hmm. in mm-hmm. quotes, yes, I'm being very facetious, swap these things out in their infinite medical training, seemingly willy-nilly. And that does have a consequence, and it can get in the way of the progresses that we are making for these patients. And also, when you're talking about that sick or dry patient, another frustration I have is these health insurance companies saying, well, you can't be on this and this. I'm like, hold up, says who, right? Hold on. There's a role for steroids and cyclosporin, steroids mm-hmm. and lifitegrast, steroids and cyclosporin, sometimes and lifitegrast, like depending on the situation. If it, let's say you've got a steroid responsive patient, steroids are off the table, and yet they'll come back and say, you have to try and fail a steroid. So I find mm-hmm. as a community that rub, excuse the pun, is getting worse and worse all the time. And I think we need to fight back and push back.
Right. I mean, don't you think it's kind of like what glaucoma went through, you know,
yes.
when all the drugs were coming out, mm-hmm. you know, it was like, everybody's trying to say, well, which one is best? Well, they're not best. They can work together, and they have mm-hmm. different roles that we need to approach. But before I forget, I do want to ask you both, do you have recommendations for our colleagues out there who haven't ever used a compounding pharmacy? How do they start? What do they do? What should they be trying to develop in their local or mail order, whatever? Will you please help our colleagues?
I think both you and I use compounding pharmacies a fair amount, and it's hard. I moved from Virginia to Colorado, and I had to figure out where I was going to use, and then places close. So you have to figure out, one, do they do ophthalmic solutions? That's the number one. And I can't even lie, I just cold call. I called a bunch when I got here, and I had to call even in Virginia to figure out, because I had one that closed that I'd been using, and I had to find a new one. And not everybody does. They don't have the hood. They don't have the certification because they don't necessarily want to or whatever. But find a place, ask a friend, see who else is in your area that may be compounding that can at least give you that information, and then work with them. One that's out of Kansas that will ship is called O'Brien's, that I found that I really like. And they've got a really comprehensive list of what they will make for you that's ophthalmic. And I think that's a good option as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that topic becomes very interesting too. To your point, there's certain licensures and good manufacturing practices that need to happen. And we do have incidences of very serious complications from improperly compounded steroids, postoperatively intraocular, TAS, endophthalmitis, injected into the spine for, you know, herniating disc disease. So I'm always a little cautious. I tend to lean on trade name products more because it gives me that little extra level of security. But to your point, if I'm up against, you know, some forced swap with a high BAK load from the insurance company, I'm going to go with a trusted compounding pharmacy. And I do think there's a handful of excellent ones out there. I personally use Imprimis quite a bit. I've had good luck with that, but I'd forgotten about O'Brien. Thank you for that reminder. They have a fabulous reputation.
Well, let's move into some new treatments for dry eye. You know, this 2023 was a big year of things getting approved. Yep. I mean, we don't usually get so many in one year, so it's pretty exciting. Let's talk a little bit about, now that they're approved and they've launched, you two are probably using them all in your practice, and I just would love to hear your thoughts, how it's going. So let's talk about perfluorohexyloctane, which goes by the trade name Mibo. How has your experience been so far? Start with you, Dr. Ketting.
It's been great. Honestly, it's been really good. I've found that for those patients who are coming in with moderate meibomian gland dysfunction, or even, you know, just mild meibomian gland dysfunction, but we know that we've got a decreased tear breakup time, we've got more evaporative dry eye. And I'm working on getting those glands better while I'm still saying, hey, we're going to do these warm compresses, we're going to do IPL and expression in or whatever, right? This helps to get them feeling better and gets the stress off that front surface, so we get less epithelial desiccation, and it just helps to clean up what's going on while I'm dealing with the essentially underlying cause. So I've had a really good experience with it, both personally using it as well as my patients. So I've been happy.
Have you had any problems with insurance or with BlinkRx?
Growing pains, yes. Yeah. Yeah, and
now that's a positive spin. Good job.
Yeah. And but we know that, right? With any, yes, well, especially this group, right? We know that anytime there's a new drug, there it's gonna be awful at the beginning, right? And there was definitely some growing pains of which pharmacy am I gonna send this to. I have kind of narrowed it down to one that I typically send it to because they have been really good at making sure that the prior auths and things are taken care of and the cost is okay. We do run into a problem still at this point, right, in March of 2024 with our Medicare patients, right? But that's, again, mm-hmm, not new. And or people who have a high deductible. And yeah, we're still kind of the beginning part of the year where a lot of people haven't met that. And that's where we run into issues. So I'm still having to be a little bit creative on some of that. But otherwise, overall, I would say like, let's go 70% has been good, which I still feels pretty high.
Mm-hmm. Have you experienced the same, Dr. Perryman?
How, as far as like the
either use
the growing pains?
Or, yeah,
as she's
use
still
or growing pains. Or both.
Yeah, yeah, same issues, but we still keep plugging along and we still keep trying. And I know that the manufacturers are doing their level best to, you know, smooth those transitions. And I really respect the commitment by, yeah, the manufacturers to do their level best to create access for patients.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we have a dedicated staffer to help streamline the prior authorizations that helps with our throughput. But again, that's another FTE that, mm-hmm, that you know, we're having to support. And yeah, it's just part of patient care. But clinically, I think it performs extremely well. And I use it, I know we studied it in the FDA trials as a QID solo modality, but I'm combining it with all kinds of other things. And it's just so refreshing to have a drop that's so well tolerated.
Yes.
It feels like a cashmere sweater on a fall day. Oh,
you are such a good descriptive person. Right? That's fantastic. Yeah, I mean, I think that patients sometimes don't even feel it. It feels so nice, you know.
Yes,
so yeah,
so
you have
nice.
To encourage them to make sure they're getting it in. Mm-hmm, very
yeah.
silky.
Yeah, usually, ooh, it's like, doc, all your drops sting. Not this.
Yeah. So, and to your point, I think that we're going to learn more. You know, of course, something gets approved, and then there's some phase four trials, and some of these phase four trials will provide some data around some of the concepts that you're probably doing in practice with your patients. You know, trying it with twice a day, trying it, you know, pre and post contact lens wear, a whole variety of different scenarios, you know, trying it pre cyclosporine or lifitegrast. And so I think we're going to really learn about, you know, what can you extend out an IPL with it? I mean, I think there's some fascinating questions that we're going to learn.
Fascinating questions. I agree. And I'll even use it for friction reduction in cases of conjunctival cholesis. Pre-procedure, pre-surgical, I shrink them. Mm-hmm. With dilute brimonidine and dilute oxymetazoline, readily available. And then that shrinks the CCH folds. That work was first presented by Melissa Toyos in 2019 at Ascaris. She's such a good clinician scientist. She showed reduction in CCH folds with branded Lumify. And so we use that technique. So I'll shrink them with the pharmacologic approach and then protect them from friction with my perfluoral hexaloctane or my MIBO, and that combination seems to work pretty well.
Actually, even following surgery too, I would imagine that.
Yes, because we know the tear films disrupt
the inflammation, the friction.
Tear breakup time's terrible post-operative, but you can help stabilize that for the first in real time for the first time ever.
Mm-hmm. Well, we mentioned that it is a cousin in terms of its molecule to what is the kind of the carrier vehicle in VVI, trade name VVI, cyclosporine ophthalmic solution 0.1%. So not the same as one another, but somewhat similar. Do either of you want to tackle the differences between the two?
I can start. So, sure. And you can fill in for me. So my understanding is that because of the molecule itself, the perfluoro, that actually helps with retention time of the cyclosporine on the surface, which allows for better penetration of the cyclosporine. And that's really kind of how it works. I don't look at MIBO and VVI as like necessarily like treating the same thing, right? They're functioning different. The molecule itself functions different. And I, like I said, I see it more as a delivery vehicle for the cyclosporine and getting a better function of that cyclosporine.
Yeah, I think that kind of the question would be, so if you were using MIBO and then you needed to add on something, you know, certainly you might choose a different cyclosporine or lefitegrast as opposed mm-hmm. to, you know, because those two things are acting differently from one another. It's yeah. not the same. Adding those two together is not the same as VVI. And so yeah. I think we're going to learn more about VVI too, as it yeah. starts to be used out there, but
yeah, I've got a ton of patients I've prescribed it for in the last couple of weeks, but I typically don't see because it came out like, what, a month ago? Mm-hmm. So I should be getting, because I do 6 weeks for my first follow-up for most patients, so I should be seeing them in the next 2 weeks and I can tell you how they're doing. But I definitely have not had callbacks on patients having any issues as far as comfort, which I wouldn't expect because I've put it in. It's very similar to the MIBO in its comfort, silkiness feeling, which makes sense with the molecule. The other thing is I have not had a lot of emails from my staff on issues with getting the drug or from patients. So that's another benefit. So I'm excited to see how it's working.
Let's hope they all show back up and actually they're not taking generic cyclosporine.
Oh, that would
I think you'd probably be hearing about it though, if they were.
I have had a couple of letters come back from pharmacy benefit managers questioning the use of perfluoral hexaloctane or MIBO plus perfluoral butyl pentane plus cyclosporine together.
We're gonna get into a chemistry class
here.
Hold
on. Sure. That's right. That's right. Now I know you know how to look up the molecular characteristics of things. This is different.
Yeah, I wonder if we're
I love it because that. Patients that normally couldn't tolerate other versions of immunomodulators, it gives them another run at a steroid sparing immunomodulator.
Yeah, no, I agree. And there's certainly, you know, in the clinical research that I do, we see patients that have discontinued on their own mm-hmm. some other version of an immunomodulator like forever. And so this really does give one more shot. Let's try it one more time and see if this makes a difference. Well, the last of the three approvals on our list is trade name XDEMVY, which is lotilaner ophthalmic solution for Demodex. How's the uptick gone in both your practices?
I love it.
I love it.
So here's the thing is what I'm thinking is that way more of my patients' problems that where it looks like it's just simply meibomian gland dysfunction and I'm not seeing collarettes are actually Demodex, but we're looking more at, and I think Laurie and I have talked about this. I think it's more the brevis versus the folliculorum and they're in the oil glands. And so I've been heavy on treating patients with good lid hygiene with, I'm a big fan of Zocufoam with okra in it as far as cleaning and because it's pretty gentle and then having them more compresses and then XDEMVY and seeing them back in 6 weeks so I can see where they're at before we start adding in all this other stuff. And just also for me, right? So I can clinically see what is it doing? What am I seeing a benefit in those patients where I'm suspecting this? And yeah, I am. And it's great. And it also works really well for those patients with all those collarettes. So I've been very, very happy with this, with the outcomes with my patients. And I think it's got a lot more application than we originally thought.
Yeah. I have a question for the two of you. Are you doing a second course of therapy in some patients?
I have not had to yet.
Okay. I've been doing that a fair bit.
Okay.
Particularly in those cases of suspected D. brevis. Because my thought process is We have new data showing that the meibomian gland secretion scores are highly statistically significantly better after a second bottle, second course of therapy. And I am seeing that improve meibomian gland secretion scores at that point. And then my other thought is, well, if it really is D. brevis that's creating all this mischief, they're burrowed down deep inside the meibomian gland where it's hard to get my medicine into it. So I need a longer contact time. The pharmacokinetics need to get in there better to help smoke out those hidden little nests of little critters.
I might try that. I definitely am telling him to finish the bottle because there's more than 6 weeks in there.
Just keep much, going.
Just finish it out. But I have not done any refills. So I'll keep that in mind, especially what made you decide to go to a second bottle? Were you looking at it and still seeing some symptoms in patients that made you continue?
Yeah, with symptoms, it's like, wow, things are somewhat better, but not enough. And I would, push on the meibomian glands. And in some cases, if you go back like 60 seconds later and look again, you'll have tons of foam cells on the lid margin. Right. I call it the Guinness beer head sign. So just like all this head of foam on the lid margins. And my
Got the Alpenglow and the Guinness beer sign.
So the thought process is, well, gosh, if it is D. brevis and they have bacillus in their gut, bacillus have lipases, maybe this is an indirect sign that I'm dealing with a brevis infestation. That's my thought process. I need to prove it. I need to get out some PCR. Kelly, do you want to work on this study with me? I think it would be so
interesting because until I'm a disbeliever. I want to see those little suckers. I mean, the data is pretty compelling, but
I have found one from inside of my meibomian gland expression plug.
Have you really?
I have found one in the wild inside the meibom.
Oh, I shouldn't say that that's cool, but that's nerdy and I love it.
It is so cool, but it's so gross.
Yeah, it's kind of gross, but it's nerdy. But so are you just going straight then? Are you just, and you know, as they finish that bottle, you're going straight into a second?
Yeah, I'm seeing them follow up at that point. And they're also getting IPL on a regular basis as well. Yeah. Like, yeah, let's go ahead and do a second bottle.
Do you think there may be some role in some sort of long-term use, like maybe once a day or something like that?
That's a great question. I don't know.
I've had patients ask that.
That's
a good question.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I know some clinicians.
At this point, no, but I don't know. Ask me in 2 years. I might have a different answer.
Because some people have found that like that they're getting the refills automatically going through, depending on how it was written or whatever, there maybe have written for a refill and it's showing up and the pharmacies are calling and saying, hey, you know, we've got this refill. Do you want it? And some of my colleagues have said that yes, their patients have taken it and they're calling wondering how much they should use for how long, which I think is interesting. Okay.
I'll try that again. I was writing refills initially when it was first available and getting all kinds of weird callback questions, but I'm going to try putting that refill back on there again.
Yeah, see what happens. You never know. I mean, of course, insurance companies have a way of figuring stuff out, but if they're selling more, if they're actually selling it, you know, they're selling more of it than you know. All right. So last but not least, we've talked some about how these therapies, these new things might actually be getting patients to better success quicker. Usually they say that patients drop off at like 6 weeks, you know, from their therapies and dry eye, and maybe even you lose them. But these new therapies might actually be helping keep a patient in the practice. Do you want to comment on that? We'll start with you, Dr. Ketting.
I would say I feel like they're helping because we are seeing quicker relief than we have historically with many of our other options within weeks versus, you know, months with some of them, right? Which is great, especially because most of the patients, especially first when we started prescribing these, were those who we were like, I had a list of all these patients who need this medication that nothing has worked for, right? And so it was nice to give them and give them to the patients who needed them and have them actually get relief and fairly quickly. So it definitely is impacting the time. It is not impacting the time of which I bring my patients back. To be honest, and most of this has been feedback through mail or them telling me when they come back, just because our clinics are so full and my clinic is so full that 6 weeks is really when I'm bringing them back. But I am glad that I feel like I'm having more of them come back and say, yes, I am still taking that versus, oh, it was awful. I stopped at week two. So I am having a good response.
Well, I think the combined like approach of the companies working so hard to make sure that the product can get out there to the doctors, as well as patients getting it and maybe having some renewed hope that something can help them a little quicker, is probably a great combination.
And I do think these meds really play nicely in the sandbox together. Everything, the immunomodulators, all the different cyclosporine formulations, lifitegrast, steroid, tear stabilization with perfluorohexaloctane. And I think they all play well together. And I think that additive approach, that synergy helps all of us look better to our patients because they're getting relief faster. We're able to customize and tailor their treatment protocols based on what we're seeing.
So it was 21 years ago when Restasis was approved. And
Wow.
if I like step back and just listen to what you just said and how you kind of talked about all these new options, wow, what a great place we're in to treat dry eye now than what we were then. It's fantastic.
Can't wait to see where the future takes us. My
Any
brighter.
final last words, Dr. Ketting, for us today?
Don't be afraid to everybody. Don't be afraid of dry eye. You don't have to be a specialist. I didn't start as a specialist. And you all have a slit lamp. You have vital dyes. You have a Q-tip. You have everything you need.
Yes, just go do it, right?
Just go do it.
Right. Well, thank you so much for being with us today. It's truly been a pleasure to have a Medcast chat with you.
Thank you for having me.
Of
Thank
course.
you.